Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, March 11th, 2025, and our friend Colonel Wilkerson is back with us. Welcome back, Colonel.
Good to be with you, Nima.
Let's get started with the new round of negotiations between the United States and Ukrainians in Saudi Arabia. We had Rubio together with Walz meeting with Ukrainians. How did you find it? And you're talking about the outcome was positive, but what do we know about that?
Nima, I can't tell from Rubio's statements, Trump's statements, such as they are, the statements of what's the guy who got himself in trouble with the Israelis, Adam Boehler, Witkoff, and all the rest of the people who are participating in this, including the Arabs. I can't tell what they're talking about. I really can't. I'm paying attention to the Israelis whom I have learned to pay attention to with regard to reality. And those Israelis are essentially saying, like, for example, the new IDF chief of staff, we're going back to war. Get yourself ready. We're going back to war. And he put the warning order out latter part of last week or early this week, Monday, or the weekend maybe. I'm trying to think of his name, the new chief of staff. Zamir. Yeah, Zamir. And it essentially said to all reservists and others in the IDF, we're going back to war. That sort of, maybe that's just a negotiating tactic, but I don't think so. I think they're fully intent on going back to war. On the other side, you have these talks initially really criticized by certain Knesset members and others of Netanyahu's ilk that were directly between the United States and Hamas. And I guess Boehler was a principal conductor of this, and now he's in some disrepute in some channels. In others, he's being hailed as a breakthrough. But what did he break through to, other than Hamas essentially saying we need a 5-year ceasefire or something like that, a big, long ceasefire, and you get all your hostages back and we get the prisoners we need back that we've told you we need? What does that mean? Does that mean Hamas is going to be welcomed back into Gaza as a part of the governing apparatus? I don't think so. Not with Netanyahu, or increasingly with Trump, nor increasingly with Rubio. Does that seem to be, and certainly not with excess, does that seem to be an eventuality? So I don't know what to figure out of this, where we're going. And the Arabs are just, to me, like the Arabs most of the time are, feckless. And then you throw Syria into it, where we've got the government saying one thing. They have stopped all the Alawite and other, you know, Assad riser-uppers, the people who decided they were going to come out of the woodwork and contest the new government in Damascus. Word last night was they have stopped them, that they've killed a few, they taught them their lesson, and they've stopped. That Erdogan is backing them from the north. But Israel is still making their incursions, as I see it, and not being stopped in any way, fashion, or form by the provisional whatever government in Damascus. So what is going on in Syria? Are we just looking at the empire using its poodle to take as much territory from other people, to kill as many Palestinians, West Bank, Gaza, wherever, as possible before we bring the hammer down and cause everything to shut down? Or maybe somebody assassinates Netanyahu. I don't know. I understand from people I trust in Israel that his livelihood, his life, his tenure politically might be extremely limited. But I've been hearing that for so long that I just discount it mostly. I don't know how to figure it out anymore. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know who's talking for whom. I don't know who's telling the truth and who's offering negotiating tactics. And I don't know if anybody means what they say when they say it, other than I think the Israelis are relentless in wanting to get rid of, and I mean kill, as many Palestinians as possible in Gaza and on the West Bank. And that's going to be their writ. And that's what the IDF is going to be doing for the next year. At the same time, I'm hearing how fractious the IDF is right now, especially the rank and file and some of the officers. So I don't know who's hiding what from whom, and I don't know what the real purpose of all this is, other than I think Netanyahu's fully intent on continuing the slaughter.
Larry, as you've mentioned, it seems that the Trump administration is negotiating, talking with Hamas in order to release American hostages, prisoners.
Yeah.
And what about the Israeli ones? What do we know? What can we get from this sort of attitude on the part of the Trump administration? Is there any sort of gap difference between the Trump administration and Netanyahu? That's why they're doing this way, or they want to just take them back and let Netanyahu do whatever he wants to do?
I think the latter. I think Bowler got himself in some trouble because he made some remarks about talking directly to Hamas, and even some remarks that might have been considered by the Israelis, who consider anything that isn't absolutely brutal and bloody about Hamas, as being favorable towards Hamas. And that put him in disfavor with the right-wing Israelis. I don't know what Trump wanted him to do, except prove that Trump could talk to anybody and anybody would talk to Trump. And Hamas made that even more profound by essentially releasing a statement, as I understand it, that the U.S. was good to talk to. U.S. hostages could be returned forthwith because the U.S. was good to talk to, which may have ricocheted to Bowler's discredit with Netanyahu, and Netanyahu might have registered that with Trump. I don't know. This is typical Trump, though, trying to probe every little place he can and back up from those that don't prove productive, or worse, produce bad results for him politically and otherwise, and then try another one. I don't know who's speaking for whom. I don't think Rubio is speaking for what's going on there. Not really. I think only people are Witkoff and Trump when you grind it down to the bottom of the can. But I don't know what that means. I do know that I think what Netanyahu is planning and what Netanyahu fully intends to resume is killing Gazans. And this business of the relief supplies and UNRWA not being allowed in, but other entities being allowed in, and what does that mean in terms of the power that's been turned off and what that means for the Gazans? And he's just making it more and more miserable for them and more impossible for them to stay. The ultimate aim being, of course, what Trump said in his kind of apocryphal remarks, that we're going to move everybody out. Everybody's going. And then you look at the Philadelphia corridor, and you understand how the Egyptians feel about that and how the Israelis are abusing how the Egyptians feel about that. Then you look at Lebanon, and you see how Lebanon's armed forces are principally apparently cooperating with the IDF right now to clear out remaining elements of Hezbollah. At the same time, Israel's violating the ceasefire that they signed years ago, it seems like, weeks, months ago. And they don't have any intention of leaving Lebanon anytime soon. Same with Syria. They're still taking territory in Syria, and the government in Damascus doesn't seem to have the capacity to keep them from doing that, nor does it have the capacity to keep the Israeli Air Force from patrolling the south rather vigorously and making sure nothing develops down there, Iranian or otherwise, Syrian, that might threaten Israel's incursions into Syria. It looks like everything I have been saying is true, that Israel operates for us, not the other way around, and that we are, thank you very much, quite content with the way they're operating right now, with a couple of wrinkles maybe around the edges, especially where those wrinkles bring global condemnation down on the empire, because people are waking up to what reality I've pointed out, that Israel is our poodle. Israel is doing what we want them to do in the Levant.
It seems that right now the issue with the Philadelphia corridor is the main issue. How is that? Is Israel afraid of Egypt to attack them? Is there
Doesn't appear to be. I think they're looking at El-Sisi as being incapable of doing anything, even though he's been threatening it. As I've said before, you know, there are Arab armies that could move at any minute and probably give the idea of a real fright, if not harm them greatly, perhaps even existentially. But I don't see that happening now. So I have to conclude that all of this was just show. Now, I go back, I think I mentioned this to you. I remember that vivid scene with Moshe Dayan after the 67 war, when that reporter was chasing him and trying to get him to tell him what the secret of his blitzkrieg victory was, you know, 6-day war. And Moshe Dayan turned on the reporter and looked at him and said, it helps in English. He said, it helps to be fighting Arabs.
Larry, what's so confusing to me is the way that Donald Trump is treating Canada and Mexico in terms of the economic war between the countries. And on the other hand, letting Netanyahu doing whatever he wants. The picture doesn't come together. If he doesn't, he is not willing to spend more money on this endless war in the Middle East, which we know that he has some sort of intention, has some sort of tendency to do that. But how is that going to work out for Netanyahu?
We'll start with the first comment you made. I don't think Trump's going to put anything over on this new leader in Canada. I think he's a pretty formidable personality, and he's got a pretty solid character, and he's all Canadian, and he's not Trudeau. He's not one of the political families of Canada. He's a businessman, in essence. And I've listened to him for about 6 months now, periodically. And before, I think he really felt like there was a chance he could be the next premier or the next leader. And then I listened to him as he grew closer and closer to the possibility that he would be the next leader. I got the opinion that he had thought all along there was a good chance, but he was being very circumspect, and he was really, his words were sharp and, in my view, full of not only wisdom, but cleverness in terms of what he might do were he to be the ultimate leader. And I think Trump has met his match there. So what does that mean? Well, it means we'll probably have a tariff duel. You see what's happening right now. And we'll probably wind up with Canada winning some of that. And what does that mean? And Trump will double down on his promise to make Canada another state and try to bring as much pressure to bear. That's what really irritates Trump, is when somebody challenges him and is successful, not only politically in his own home, but politically in the world in general. This guy's going to be that way. I'm not so sure the Mexican president isn't of the same kind of character. So this is going to be interesting to watch. And you see what our stock market is doing, and you see what the NASDAQ is doing, and you see what people are saying about that and what it might mean for the economy in the long term for Trump being the next 3.5 years. And you wonder if Trump understands what he's doing. And yet this is supposed to be his acumen. This is supposed to be his forte. This is supposed to be where he should excel in the business world, in commerce, in economics. It doesn't look to me like there's a lot of that going on, though. What it looks like to me is the reverse of that is going on. And that, to me, is the only thing Trump has, really. I'm sure the cult behind Trump, for them, he has a lot more. But for those people who flocked to Trump because they thought Biden had really made a mess of things in a number of fields, including the economy, I think they're going to be disappointed pretty sharply. And that's going to reflect in the midterms. And what is Trump going to do when he loses big time in the midterms? I don't see, you know, I had this hope that not only would he end the Ukraine war, but some of the things he wanted to do, to include the organizational effectiveness, that's what we would have called it in the military, going after, you know, what Elon Musk is supposed to be single man in charge of, going after modernizing the U.S. bureaucracy, if you will. I don't see that happening very smoothly either. So I'm not confident that we're going to see anything but worse stuff from the Trump administration.
Here is, Larry, here is what he posted on his social media based on Canada placing a 25% tariff on electricity coming into the United States. I have instructed my Secretary of Commerce to add an additional 25% tariffs. It's going to be 50% tariffs on aluminum, steel, and
base metal. I forget the exact outcome, but I think we stiffed, and Trump had something to do with it. Biden started it. We stiffed the Japanese offer to buy U.S. steel. So at the same time we're doing this, we're doing that, which doesn't make a lot of sense.
So, Larry, how can we put these two pictures together? The way that Donald Trump is fighting Canada and Mexico just for the sake of the economy of the United States. And on the other hand, letting Netanyahu to continue to go again on Gaza to go and fight in Gazans, or I don't know, bombing Gazans, which we know that the United States should give weapons, everything to Israel to do that.
Well, I think that I would make the comparison between what he's doing supposedly with regard to shutting down this bloody war in Ukraine and what he's doing in the Levant to let the bloody war and killing go on. I'm not sure there's an economic connection between the two, other than the fact that we have spent far too much on defense and are still spending too much on defense. And there's certainly a military implication. I don't know if you saw the report. We've been talking about this all along. The Army has these two programs going, you know, because they can't recruit enough Americans to serve. And the programs are, one, to get the fat off people, the one quarter of American 18 to 24-year-olds who are too obese to serve. That program reduces their fat and lets them serve. The other program, they're not intellectually capable of passing the battery of tests you have to pass to get in the military. So they teach them the test, and then they pass. Well, we just had our first report on these two-year enlistees under these programs. The Army lost 25% of its two-year enlistees, and many of them were these people. So not only can they not recruit, they also can't retain now. So that's got to be played into this whole situation too. It's just too much money going out to the military, far too much money going out to the military, almost $1 trillion now. So we're looking at the need to shut down both theaters, really. We're looking at the need to stop the war. And I'm not just talking about the killing and the brutality of the war in the Levant, or for that matter, Ukraine. You know, they got the cursed salient now surrounded. They got it absolutely surrounded. And that's probably 10,000 of Ukrainians' best soldiers. They're trapped. They're either going to be killed, captured, or they're going to surrender. It's going to be a massacre if they try to fight. And since these are some of the better troops Ukraine has fielded, they might just try to do that. So this is going to be a massacre in the Kursk salient. But we're not moving fast enough on the one, Ukraine, and we're not even moving on the other one. We're just still going, and that's bleeding stocks and bleeding money too. So I don't know what Trump's intent is when he leaves alone the most excessive drain on American tax dollars, and that's the military. And he leaves the wars alone, which are because of the military and the need for the money to be spent on the military in these wars. He lets them go on, and they are draining the coffers as rapidly as Medicare or Medicaid. And that he's apparently going after with vengeance now. So I don't understand how he's thinking about these changes he wants to make and how they're to be ameliorative rather than damaging. And there are a lot of people out there now that are responding, Republicans who voted for it, who are responding about particularly the efforts of Musk that are causing people to lose their jobs, lose their salaries, of course. And they've got people in university, they've got car payments, they've got house payments, mortgages, so forth. It's not going down very well. Again, coming back to the midterms, it's not politically wise to be doing some of these things he's doing, or at least not in the crass way they're doing it and with the speed that they're doing it. And in some cases, I think the eras with which they're doing it. Some of these lawsuits the Democrats are bringing are not just politically frustrated lawsuits. They are genuine lawsuits from people who think they're breaking the law and very probably are right.
It seems that Ukrainians were trying to attack Russia with over 300 drones.
Yes.
And which didn't get any sort of positive outcome for Ukrainians. Here is,
as I understand it, the threat now issued by Moscow is they're coming back with the Reshniks. Yeah. And that probably means Kyiv.
Here is, it seems that in the first round of negotiations between the United States and Ukrainians, they were talking about the mineral deal, which we're supposed to talk about, and the ceasefire for the case of the attacks from the sea and from the air. And it seems that the Ukrainian side has agreed on having some sort of ceasefire in terms of these two sort of attacks. What does that mean? It means that the no drone attacks, no missiles, no, I don't know, is that going to help the situation in Ukraine?
If that's a negotiating tactic to show the Russians, or the Russians show the Ukrainians, or both, hopefully, that they are slowing down the combat and thus the killing in order to get prepared for negotiations and to give each side some confidence in those negotiations, that's a good move. It's a terrific move. I'd rather, you know, if you have to move in steps, so be it. But I'd rather see an overall ceasefire. I'd like to see them stop firing at one another, period. Drones, Reshniks, whatever. I'd like to see it shut down and stop. And then maybe a little time go by before they sit down and begin to talk about that cessation of hostilities and how they might work out an ultimate peace agreement. It's getting harder every day that goes by, because you've got the Duma putting pressure on Putin. You've got Putin putting pressure on his generals. You got people in Russia who want this over. You got people now in Ukraine who want this over. And I think you have increasing numbers in Europe that want this over too. Even though we did just, as I understand it, succeed finally in, for example, getting Georgescu in Romania thrown out of the political process, a victory for that woman at the EU. But still, we need to start taking measures that look like we are actually working on a ceasefire peace agreement. How the details are worked out, I agree with the people like Mearsheimer and Chas Freeman, for example, and others, that it's going to be very difficult to negotiate the ceasefire because of the different sides' wishes and desires and such. And I think it's going to be particularly difficult to enforce it, not because of the Russians, because I don't think they'll break it. I think we need to worry about the Ukrainians and elements in Ukraine, particularly when Zelensky's gone, which is going to happen, I think, taking their own measures, just as they did all throughout the 2000s, to make the Russians mad enough to start it back up again. That'll be their fundamental tactics, I think, is they'll use guerrilla tactics to hit the Russians, and then the Russians will get angry with that, and we'll have no more ceasefire. That's going to be the problem, I think, is maintaining what we achieve in initial talks, and then having smart, wise talks after that that reaffirm that and create a situation in which we can walk away from, I think, and when I say walk away, I think move up to would be a better phrase, move up to what I've been saying all along, is we need a whole new European security architecture And that architecture needs to include Russia. But the more you fight, the more you kill people, the more brutal the fighting is, the more you kill, the more difficult, the more years have to pass before you can get to the point where you talk about those things, because people have such visceral hatreds going into it.
It seems one of the main reasons behind this attack, drone attack on Russia, which was unprecedented so far during the conflict, with these quantities of drones attacking Russia, which has failed so far from what we've learned so far. And it seems that they were trying to put some sort of pressure on American side that they're able to attack Russia from the air.
And I've always said that I think the real problem here, the real challenge, is not that Russia's going to attack other NATO countries like Biden claimed all the time and Blinken claimed all the time, or much of the American intelligentsia claims all the time. Oh my God, if we don't stop them in Ukraine, they'll be in Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia next. That's bull. Putin has no intent on doing that, and he has no desire whatsoever to take on, to energize a reignition of NATO, if you will, and take them all on. He has no desire to do that. The problem's on the other side. The problem is the people who want to keep this going because they hate Russians. They despise Russians. And they do not want the Russians in Europe. They do not want the Russians participating. They want the Russians to go away. They would prefer them to go on the other side of the Urals and all die. That's the way some of these people feel. That's the way Victoria Nuland felt. And I'm not so sure that Sullivan, Blinken, and Biden didn't feel that way too. It was very visceral with them. And this kind of hatred is difficult to deal with, especially if you want to bring the European architecture, security architecture, to include Russia. So the violators are not going to be Russia. Russia's not going to attack Estonia or Latvia or Poland or any other place. It's going to be those countries irritated at the settlement that Trump might achieve, irritated at the fact that it was achieved over their head, and wanting to do something about that, and particularly people like Starmer, and I don't know about Mertz yet. I don't think Mertz is going to be able to put together a government that would support him if he did say he wanted to join Starmer and Macron ultimately and thwart the United States and keep the war going. But they will figure ways to foul this peace up and foul the ceasefire up. If we don't watch it really closely, and even if we watch it closely, they might figure out ways, because after all, they're there. They're at hand. And it's easier to operate from a base where you have interior lines and you are present than it is to cross the Atlantic and bring your power to bear. And especially when you're as flighty and as mercurial as Trump is.
Larry, if we assume the main objectives of the conflict in Ukraine was to overstretch Russia economically and militarily so Russia can collapse from within, it seems like the Soviet Union in those days. It seems that the European Union is turning to be the new Soviet Union for us in the current time.
It worked well, didn't it? Our strategy worked well, didn't it? We bled them to death. Putin's in the street there. He's in the square in Moscow begging for relief. You know, it's the hardest thing in the world, Neiman, to convince a state, particularly a state possessed of the power that the empire still has, much of it residual, but still there and haunting the world. It's almost impossible to convince it to retract and be smart and be wise. That's the first problem. And then the second problem is you got the Europeans in there, and the Europeans are acting as if they do not want to give up until Russia is lying in the street, bleeding and screaming, "I surrender." And where did this come from? Where in hell did this come from? Because Kohl and Mitterrand and Gorbachev and Shevardnadze and Powell and H.W. Bush and Jim Baker, they got along fine. They got along fine because they were wise statesmen. They were wise diplomatists. They knew how to manipulate and use power smartly, wisely. They knew how to coat that power in diplomacy that worked. We don't have any leaders, Nima. We have no leaders. We have no leaders in Europe, and we have no leaders in America. Not really. That even know what they're doing half the time. And they certainly aren't those kinds of leaders. It must mystify. Have you been watching any of this, that Judge Napolitano and Larry Johnson and the group that went to Moscow? I almost wish I had said yes and gone along with them, rather than, I'm just too old to travel that far. But if you listen to what supposedly Sergei Lavrov and others said to them, and they said back to him, and the exchanges they had, it's like the Russian diplomats who really matter, who really are smart and steeped in world affairs, can't figure us out. They're mystified, but they're also very, very mistrustful, because we have been so deceitful. And of course, Sergei could sit there and go chapter and verse, starting about 2003 or so. And he can, and as you get towards Ukraine, he can start giving you chapter and verse on what's happened and how we have been so deceitful and our allies have been so deceitful. I don't know how you patch that up. I really don't. And Trump is apparently aware of how bad the situation is, and he wants to patch it up. Or maybe it's just he wants to patch it up because he understands the economic factors at work here. I don't know. But he does not seem to have a real plan on how to do it. Stop the war, turn off the money, turn off the weapons, and that'll end everything. Well, I'm sorry, you got a bunch of people in there that don't want to end everything, and they're called Europeans.
Larry, do you think that the Europeans are on the same path that we've been witnessing with the Soviet Union? Are they going to go the same way? Are they going to understand if they insist on the way that they're trying to continue this endless war in Ukraine? They're gonna face huge challenges, devastating challenges.
Absolutely. And I don't think particularly the EU leadership understands that, or they're just tossing it aside. We can do this on our own. We're going to stand up. We're going to do 5% of GDP in every one of the states, and we're going to show the empire that we can do it. You know, throw our social programs away, do everything else, because you can't do both at the same time. So we're going to continue to be politically successful. You are. If you start doing that, I'm sorry, you're going to have turmoil in every European country if you cast aside all this luxurious social program net that you've created in Denmark and all across Europe, really. So I don't know how they're figuring. I do know that I think the criticism I've always heard of the EU and of Brussels in general, that they were anything but democratic, that they're more like an autocratic state overhanging the democracies that are under them in the European Union, is more and more true, if not absolutely true. And that's what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with these people who think they have ultimate power and have the right to wield that ultimate power. And if the United States doesn't like it, it can lump it. That's not going to work either way. It's not going to work with their wielding of the power against Russia, and it's not going to work with their telling the United States to lump it. It's just not. And they're going to wind up being out in the cold between the two giants that have been warring and want to end it. But they can make a mess. They can make a mess of that end.
Larry, what's so positive about Donald Trump is the way that he's talking about the nuclear program. Here is what he said.
Denuclearization. Correct. And that's where the cutting of Correct. The spending oh, okay. came in.
I never said cut. No, it's not in these days. I'd love to cut defense spending, but not now. Because you have China, you have Russia, yeah, you have a lot of problems saying, yeah. out there. No.
In fact,
no, what I have said is we spend a lot of money on nuclear missiles. Nuclear weapons, the level of destruction is beyond anything you can even imagine. It's just bad that everybody has to spend all this money on something that, if it's used, it's probably the end of the world.
Yeah. At least he understands the situation with the nuclear bombs.
Right, and he's talked to Putin, and Putin has more or less agreed, and Xi Jinping has said he's willing to talk too. I'm not sure Trump understands the connection between the NDAA defense budget and what he's talking about with regard to the now probably, I would guess, throw in cost overruns and everything, it's at least $2 trillion over the next few years that they're going to spend to modernize, securitize, and insuritize our nuclear stockpile. I'm not sure he understands how that works, but some of it is going to have to come out of the defense budget because some of it's in the defense budget. So if you cut the nuclear stockpile, like he's saying, by 50%, even roughly 50%, you're saving a lot of money, which is, I'm sure, part of Putin's motivation and probably Xi Jinping, too. If he could stop his build out, which he is going to do now, if he could stop it, or maybe others have said, well, I think Chas Freeman said, you got to build up to equivalency with Moscow and Washington, and then he'll cut. Okay, that might sound good to a diplomat, but I think the economist in Xi Jinping would probably say, well, you know, maybe I'll just build up to where you are going to be once you reach the 50%. Because that would be a significant buildup, because the Chinese only have about 600, and we've got, each of us got close to 10,000, maybe 11,000 together, you know, 6,000 in one, maybe 5,600 in the other, close to 11, 12,000 nuclear warriors. So if we could get to doing this, this would be a monumental achievement for Trump and a monumental achievement for the world, because these are dangerous weapons, and we're back again, like we were in the Cold War, in the middle of an arms race. We're trying to get modernization and numbers to surpass, get this, a combined arsenal of China and Moscow, thinking that that's the only way we're going to be safe, is to match their numbers in combination. That's insanity, and it's also extremely expensive. And if we could stop that, Trump has figured that out, and more power to him in doing it. We need to set a date certain, have a summit, maybe have all three leaders there if Xi Jinping will come. I'm sure Putin has said that he will be willing to be there. And we have that summit in Geneva or whatever. We have a meeting and we talk about it. And then we put in experts, working parties, and all the paraphernalia that we did in the 90s, for example, when we were reducing by, 50,000 nuclear warheads and delivery vehicles. And that's what they're talking about. They're talking about the warheads and the delivery vehicles, ballistic missiles, submarines, and bombers, and the bombs that go on them and warheads that go in them. This would be a monumental achievement for Trump. And it would also help all three countries manage their finances better, because these are extremely expensive weapons. But the main thing is the danger. I mean, if we're talking about existential dangers to the human race, there are two looming right in front of us: nuclear weapons and climate.
Larry, how do you see Donald Trump managing the situation with the European Union, as we know that Emmanuel Macron is talking about building new nuclear bombs in order, right, I don't know, whatever he has in his mind in order to confront Russia? How is that going to work out with this attitude of Donald Trump? He's talking about having some sort of negotiations with Russia, China, and to reduce the nuclear bombs.
Macron, are you saying, would Macron join Trump, Putin, and Xi Jinping?
Yeah. Or he's going to confront Trump?
Yeah, if he's going to confront him, I'd love to see him sell that to the French people. I'll give you odds. I give you good odds and bet you he's not going to sell that to the French people. They have a very small stockpile. They call it their force de frappe, I think, the little force. And so does Britain, very small stockpile. But the two of them together, I don't think they would be, I just don't think they'd be able to convince their people, the current leaders, convince their people to put the money forward to build out further. These are very expensive weapons, very expensive weapons. Probably the most expensive weapons. Well, no, not probably. They are the most expensive weapons we've ever invented. That's one reason when we were in the 2001, 2002, three period dealing with the AQ Khan network, you may recall, that was a very persuasive argument with people, even like Gaddafi, who had lots of money, was how expensive these darn weapons are and how little you get back for that expense, because you become, in many respects, a pariah state. Look at Israel, for example. Israel would say, well, we've guaranteed our existence with these nuclear weapons. Have you really? Have you really? Or have you guaranteed that when it comes down to it, and maybe the empire gets fed up with you, you have to use one on yourself? And that's why you have the Samson option. And what do you think that's going to do for you, except destroy your country?
Larry, you've mentioned...
can you imagine Israel using a nuclear weapon on another state without that state ultimately destroying Israel, even though it might not have nuclear weapons? I mean, it would recover, and it would vow, and it would never give up that vow until it had destroyed Israel. I don't know what nuclear weapons do for Israel, really. I don't know what we thought they did for Israel when we gave them to Israel, Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Larry, you've mentioned the meeting that Larry Johnson had with Sergey Lavrov, and I talked with him, and he said that in that meeting... Larry Johnson had with Sergey Lavrov. He's in Russia.
Whom did you talk with, Sergey or Larry?
No, I talked with Larry Johnson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on phone. Yeah.
I thought maybe you got Sergey to come on your podcast.
No.
You should ask him.
Yeah.
No, I'm serious. You should ask him. He might come on. He might surprise you.
Yeah. Maybe in the future that we don't have these sort of limitations.
Wouldn't that be a coup if you got Wang Yi to come on and Sergey?
But by the way, Larry, in this talk between Larry Johnson, in this sort of talks that they had in Moscow, Sergey Lavrov was pointing out that on the part of Russians, they cannot accept Zelensky to negotiate with. This is one of the main important points that they've made in this 2 hours talk between Larry and other people with Sergey Lavrov. And how is that going to work out, Larry? How is that going to influence this sort of attitude, influence the Trump administration in order to have some sort of presidential election in Ukraine?
It's my understanding, it may not be accurate, but it's my understanding that there was not that kind of opposition prior to the meeting in the Oval Office. That is to say, with some grudging acceptance, Putin might have let Zelensky eventually come sit at the table. But after that meeting in the Oval Office, and they saw Zelensky perform in front of the cameras, and I'm told that they played that several times, they then made up their minds that he was not going to darken the door of any negotiations that they would be a part of. And I can hardly blame them. Especially Lavrov, who would see him, Lavrov, I should say, I keep saying his name wrong. Sergey would see Zelensky as being a spoiler. That is to say, you'd never get anything productive done because he would be constantly doing the kinds of things he was doing with Trump. Even though people blame Trump for putting it out on the air, as it were, still Zelensky was part of that, and he played his part. And he played his part like I think Zelensky would play his part ultimately were he with the Russians in peace negotiations. So I can see why they wouldn't want him there. I wouldn't want him there. If I were Trump, I wouldn't want him there. He's just a disruptive agent. And he does not, I think, anymore represent all of Ukraine. And there needs to be a new leader. And that leader needs to be convinced that his mandate, and this is really frustrating, his mandate is what Zelensky says his mandate was when he first was elected. And that was no war, neutrality and no war. And then he got bribed out of that by the United States of America and by Europe. So we need somebody like that again, who's elected and elected on the platform of ending the war with the best possible deal for Ukraine, but realizing that there's going to have to be some concessions. That's the kind of leader that needs to be verified by an election and then sent to the talks. And then the Russians nor the U.S., I don't think, will have any objections to that person with that mandate, both from the people and from his own voices, his own words about ending the war. That kind of person will be a welcome at the peace table. Zelensky has made himself into a uniform-wearing warrior who cannot go back to Mufti and be a peacetime president. He simply can't. And that meeting in the Oval Office demonstrated it in spades. And Sergei and Vladimir saw that. And nope, no Zelensky.
I don't know what is the connection between Zelensky and the British government, but it seems that they do have a lot of leverage personally on Zelensky. And if you remember, that's why they sent Boris Johnson to talk with Zelensky in those days to convince him to go to fight Russia, not negotiate.
Yeah.
How
maybe
do you see?
Maybe they've promised him a house in the a seat in the House of Lords, and he can continue to wear his uniform.
How, Larry? Do you think that would facilitate? That would help Donald Trump to put pressure on Zelensky, or that would make some sort of troubles with Donald Trump and his administration? I'm talking about the connection that Zelensky has with the British government, with the intelligence in the United Kingdom.
It could present a problem. I understand Starmer has promised to, if Trump has done it, he said he was going to do it, and I was told he told the Pentagon to do it, cut off all sharing, U.S. intel sharing. Starmer apparently said, I'll pick it up. Well, the first question I asked myself was, have things changed so dramatically? Because I remember when the British had to come to us for national technical means. That is to say, we're the only people with that family of satellites up there in the air that can give you blanket coverage everywhere on the face of the earth, but particularly now since we've honed so much of it in on the space over Ukraine and that portion of Russia that abuts Ukraine. So how is Starmer going to do this? Was he just talking out of his rear end, which is Starmer's habit? Or does Britain suddenly have national technical means that match ours or come close to it so that he can give the guidance that we were giving to the Ukrainians, guidance in terms of weapons and such? I don't know, but it didn't exist when I was in government. The reason that European countries, call it the Five Eyes even, the reason Germany and others adhered so religiously to sharing human-gained intelligence, we call it HUMINT, with us when we were short HUMINT sources, and generally speaking, they were in the area we were looking at, and so they had better HUMINT sources than we did, we traded national technical means in a sense. You know, we said, okay, you got access to our satellites and NSA intercepts and all that kind of stuff. We get human from you. That's kind of the intelligence exchange we had. Very favorable. They did human really well. We did NTM really well, satellites and such. If that's changed, it's news to me. If the Brits have the same capability we do, where did they get the $100 billion just for the satellites to do it? I don't think Starmer, I think he's talking out his hat. I don't think he can give them, he may be able to give them a few things, but I don't think he can give them blanket coverage like we were giving them.
when it comes to this drone attack on Russia, considerable drone attack on Russia, over 300 drones Ukraine has launched toward Moscow. And if Donald Trump is not providing them with intelligence, who's providing them with intelligence? Is that the British government?
Well, now that's a different item. Yeah, that's less sophisticated. I'm talking about things like HIMARS, you know, things that actually need feeding as they go on their route. They may have the kind of limited intelligence necessary to put drones in the air and to strike targets fairly reliably and accurately. And they may be able to furnish that. And you're right. The only damage that I can see in the last year, really, that the Ukrainians have been able to do on the Russians in a significant way is with the drones. They have actually slowed the Russian pace on the main line of contact with those drones. I think now, though, from what I'm hearing, the Russians have figured out some of that drone technology, and they're turning it around and using it on the Ukrainians. And in fact, I'm hearing that they're doing it in such a sophisticated way that a drone that's aimed at a Russian frontline system might be taken over by the Russians, flown down behind the Ukrainian personnel carrier, go in the Ukrainian personnel carrier and kill everybody. And that's been a real shock on the front lines, that the Russians have managed to reverse engineer, if you will, some of these drones and to send them back, use Ukraine's own weaponry on Ukraine's own soldiers. And that's kind of shifting the balance on the front lines too now. But this is the way it does. It goes back and forth as you learn how to defeat your enemy's technical means, if you will. And then he learns how to overcome that. Then you learn how to overcome that. And it just keeps on going. The problem for Ukraine is it can't keep on going, especially if the United States turns off everything that's giving it, money, weaponry, and such. Europe can't fill that gap that fast and that fluidly and that copiously. And so the Russians are ultimately going to gain in that circle of attack, counterattack, attack, counterattack. They're going to gain ascendancy, and they're going to be back to moving 10, 15 kilometers again a day. And this, you know, and the casualties are just going to mount. And at the end of the day, as we've said many times, people, they just don't have the people. They don't have the ability to stand up to a nation that is 3, 4, 5 times bigger than they are. I think probably the latter numbers now, given all the people who've left Ukraine and all the people who've been killed. I'm talking about 140 to 150 million against 20 million.
Larry, don't you think that the best security guarantee that the West can give to Ukraine would be Ukraine's neutrality forever?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's something Sergei Lavrov and Vladimir Putin and all the Russians that are around them, that's something they would go for. That's something they've been shooting for all along. And God, I go back to an article I wrote back in 2005 or 6, I can't remember, somewhere in there. I said, the only answer for Ukraine, anticipating some of this situation, not that we would be so lying and cheating and deceitful, not that Victoria Nuland would become the face of the American empire, and Blinken, Sullivan, and Biden would be so stupid and so unwise. I never contemplated that. But I did contemplate that there would be problems, and I said the only future for Ukraine is neutrality. Neutrality. It makes so much sense. Zelensky was even saying that in the beginning. Neutrality. Don't take anybody's side. Be a Switzerland in the heart of Europe, you know? You still would have had Russians and Ukrainians, you know, battling a little bit, because those Nazis in Ukraine, that's one thing Putin is right about. Those people would have been exacerbating the front lines, as it were, all the time. They'd have been taking on Russians in the oblast where they predominated. They would be electing governments that said, okay, you can't teach Russian, you can't speak Russian, you can't educate your children in Russian. But you could deal with that. You could deal with that with wise leaders in Kyiv. The problem I saw from 2002 on, when I was working with Ukraine, is they didn't have any wise leaders. What they had was people who wanted to be head of the government so they could rape, pillage, and plunder the Ukrainian people.
Larry, this desperate behavior on the part of European countries is because of the United States leaving Europe, or they cannot manage themselves. That's why they're feeling this way. They cannot have some sort of unity without the United States.
Both, I think, and that's why it's so crucially bad, because they know it will take them, in their terms, a long time to replace us and to do it all themselves. They can't do it overnight. They can't do it in a year. They can't do it in 5 years. Take a decade or longer. We projected, when we were talking about standing up that European security identity in 1991, we're talking about a 3,000-man brigade. Nima, that's all we're talking about, a brigade of 3,000 soldiers. Think of it as non-NATO soldiers who nonetheless could draw on war stocks and anything else they had nationally and do what Europe wanted them to do within the confines of Europe. And it would grow, and it would turn into a division and maybe even a corps finally. And that would eventually become an adjunct to NATO. But as the Cold War proved itself as being over, they would go away. NATO would go away. And the Europeans would stand up their own security identity, and it would be just like NATO, but with only the U.S. nuclear shield, not U.S. troops actually on the ground in NATO. Now, there was some thought and provision for what we used to call Reforger, Ready Forces Germany. There would be units in the United States that were earmarked to go to Europe very rapidly if there were an emergency, and they would do like they did during the Cold War. They would go to Europe periodically, say once every 3 years, once every 2 years, whatever, and train with the Europeans so we would maintain interoperability and the ability to deal with one another. But they would grow up, essentially, and we would still reinforce them, but they would grow up and take care. Think the Balkans. Think Bosnia-Herzegovina. Think Kosovo. So they would have done all that, not the UN and not NATO. They would have done that. That's the kind of thing we were thinking about. Well, that's what they got to do now. Our timeline was 20 years. Our timeline for them to stand up and to be to that point where we would say, okay, we'll go to Ready Forces Germany. We'll give you our nuclear shield. We're coming home. No more troops. And we started downsizing. We were, I forget what we were, close to 300,000. We went down to 100,000 almost. So that's dead. They've got to start it all over again. And now they're talking about they're going to do it, you know, by 5% of GDP, and we'll do it in a year or two. You know, they're not going to do it. They're not going to do it that fast. It's going to be painful politically. It's going to be painful. Are they going to draft again? Are they going to have conscription to fill these numbers that they're going to have to fill in order to provide their own defense? What are they going to do? Go back to what they were before? These are political questions. They're huge questions. And I don't think that the German youth, the French youth, the Danish youth, the Dutch youth, I don't think they're going to be that much more responsible than our youth. And we cannot recruit to the numbers that are even close to what our mouth says they should be. We're talking about fighting China, Nima. 2.5 million of them and more. We can't even field a land army of higher than 500,000. We couldn't field 500,000, really.
Larry, as an outcome of the new administration and the new attitude of the Trump administration, we had this conflict in Syria just boiling up, and we had Russia and the United States together asking for a Security Council meeting at the UN, which was yesterday. And they were talking about the situation in Syria. What are the main concerns on the part of these two countries, in your opinion?
You mean Russia and the US?
Yeah.
I got to go back to my original formulation, Nima. Israel's our attack dog in the Levant, and Israel wants Syria, or vast proportions of it. And lots of water, lots of dams, lots of lakes, lots of rivers. Have you seen Netanyahu on top of the mountain talking about what a wonderful place it is? A little bit cold, he said. The skiing resort, which was a skiing resort for all the aristocrats of that region, you know, they own it now. Mount Hermon, they own it. He's very happy with that ownership. He's not about to turn that loose. He's going to take more. He's going to take as much of Syria as we tell him to take. Russia knows that. China knows that. Turkey knows that. I can't believe they're so stupid that they don't know it. They don't look at AIPAC as being the problem in the United States. They look at Washington as being the problem and Israel being an instrument of that problem. And that's the valid way to look at it. So I don't know what we're talking about other than Russia and maybe Turkey, if finally, maybe China, I don't know, coming in to kind of thwart that a bit and to warn us off. And caught in the middle is this new government in Damascus, which is increasingly having trouble ruling. And they understand they're having trouble ruling. And I think they're beginning to understand why. They seem to be looking to Erdogan for more protection. And I think Erdogan is going to give them. But I don't know. You got Iran. You got Russia with Iran. You got China in a sort of a pact with Russia. You got North Korea in a sort of a pact with Russia. You got the BRICS. You got Syria caught in the middle of the Arab world, where the Arabs are so feckless that they won't do anything of consequence themselves. They think they can buy every problem into resolution. And they proved that on 4 March, and they'll prove it again and again and again. And you got a leader in Damascus who showed some real skill and talent and bravery and courage in getting his country back for a lot of people who are now returning and finding that it isn't as nice as they thought it was going to be, because people are still contesting the ruins, the bones, the carcass of Syria. And I got to give him credit. I don't know where he came from. Well, I do know where he came from, and I know what we were using him for, but I don't know where he got this current set of principles that he seems to be evincing. But I'm for him if he believes in them, and someone ought to give him a chance. But we're not going to. Nima, we're not going to. We haven't lifted sanctions. We're not going to lift sanctions. We're going to let Israel do whatever Israel wants to do in the area until we tell Israel enough.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today. Next time we're going to talk.
You're going to be on my big screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big screen. I hope. Got my fingers crossed.
Yeah. Thank you, Larry.
In fact, Friday, we're scheduled for Friday, right?
On Friday, yeah.
Yeah, I hope to be up by then.
Yeah, on Friday, right. Together with Ambassador Chas Freeman, yeah.
Right. Look forward to seeing him again.
Yeah,
I used his. You remember he talked about we're not being recorded, are we?
No, we are recording. Let's get out of this.
I'll be quick. You remember he talked about don't say multipolar, say multinodal.
Yeah.
So I've been passing that on to all these people who say multipolar.
Yeah, that would be amazing. I think that's a brilliant idea on the part of the
I think it is a better term. Yeah. And no one should be seeking hegemony, not really. Neither economic, financial, trade, cultural, religious, or military hegemony. We all should be in a battle to save the human race from nuclear weapons and from the climate. I got friends in South Carolina right now who are telling me they never seen fires like these. And I said, well, you're going to see more of them. And you're going to see more of them principally because the wind is picking up. And the wind's going to be more constant and harder. And fires love wind.
Yeah, exactly. See you, Larry. See you on Friday. Take care.
Bye-bye.